You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest today on the podcast is Michael Norton, who is the Harold M. Brierley Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Not familiar with it. He is the co-author with Elizabeth Dunney of Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending, and he has been selected by Wired Magazine as one of the 50 people who will change the world. And his TEDx talk, How to Buy Happiness, has been viewed more than 4.5 million times. Is that true?
Yeah, well, your parents can click a lot.
Wow, that's a lot. His new book is called The Ritual Effect, From Habit to Ritual, Harness the Surprising Power of Everyday Actions. Mike Norton, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to see you again.
So we're live at Second City, but we're not live in front of anyone. We're just between ourselves. But it's kind of fun. You were in town, and we decided to do this person to person.
Yeah, it's great. So
one of the most significant arguments that came during the 5 years that Second City collaborated with the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago was when we were co-designing an exercise about how people can practice speaking through difference. And we needed a list of relatively low-stakes arguments people could have. So we picked like crunchy peanut butter versus smooth peanut butter, cats or dogs. And the one that our behavioral scientists' friends couldn't fathom that people cared about was whether you should hang your toilet paper so the roll goes under or over. They could not believe that anyone cares about this. But as my wife will tell you, to this day, when any of us teach that exercise, that gets the most extreme response. Like, people are ready to battle. And this shows up in your book.
It's incredible. The reaction that you have to people who do it differently is, it's not just that they're wrong, it's like they're disgusting. Do you know what I mean? Yes. Like, it's offensive to me that could ever pull it from the bottom as opposed to the top. And every couple, I shouldn't say every couple, so many couples disagree. So yeah, they're constantly flipping the toilet paper back and forth to try to get it. And then when you have kids, now you got too many people in the audience and everybody's switching it around all the time, you know?
I love that the chapter is How to Divide Us, and it's like, go straight to toilet paper.
Exactly.
Like, but that is your point, correct?
It's incredible. You know, the other big one is, of course, loading the dishwasher.
Oh, yeah. Actually, that I don't let my wife near the loading of the dishwasher.
If you're in a big crowd and you say, raise your hand if your spouse loads the dishwasher incorrectly. Every hand, including couples sitting with each other. Every single hand. It's an extraordinary, and of course, no one knows how to load it correctly.
I might steal that. The thing I've been doing in my keynotes is I say, raise your hand if you've ever worked at a place you would call functional. And like, no one raises their hand.
Crickets.
There's just literally the only people who ever raised their hand was all these sweet principals in like downstate Illinois who really believed it. And I'm like, I got terrible news for you.
This is not the session for you.
And you're the only one who thinks it's functional. Oh, so funny. You say in that chapter, quote, conflicts near and far at our dining room tables and on the international stage erupt over the smallest ritual violations. And I think that word, violations, is really important because that's where you get the sort of indignity part. It's not just that we disagree.
It's that you are wrong. I mean, we see it for sure when another big one, of course, is for couples when the first time you go to the other person's holiday.
Yeah.
And they're doing everything wrong.
Right.
You know, in the U.S., it could be Thanksgiving, and you just are horrified. They eat at the wrong time. You know, they have
the wrong
stuffing.
The stuffing, yeah.
The pies. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have football on, and they should, or they have it on, and they shouldn't. And you're just so angry and uncomfortable with these people. And again, it's not just that they're doing it differently. It's wrong.
Yeah.
You have this feeling of almost moral outrage that these people could be having ham.
And I think what this strives at is a thing Nir Eyal, who I had on the podcast a long time ago, in his book, he says it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil. So that's what this is, right? These rituals are superpowers. They're wonderful, and the reason they're superpowers is they can turn into these dark places.
Very, very quickly. I mean, when I give talks, I'll often have people do a group ritual together. Mm-hmm. I'll give them instructions, you know, clap and stomp and all this stuff. People sync up very quickly. They're very excited about it. Everybody loves each other. But if somebody does it wrong, you know, if we're all clapping mm-hmm. in unison, clap, 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 and then you hear someone clap at the wrong time, rage, you know?
Yeah.
What is he doing? Why did he get it wrong? And people say, you're doing it wrong.
Right.
And I say, but I just made it up. I mean, yeah. You've never done this ritual before. I told you I made it up.
Right.
And very quickly, it does both things. It bonds us together if we're all in on it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very same time, get them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're clapping wrong. Let's get them. And if it happens with clapping, you can imagine how it plays out in the real world.
I can't remember. So, you know, we met when you came here with some other academics for a weekend of sort of immersion in Second City.
Everybody's very jealous of that? Hanging out with academics for a weekend.
Yes, yes. We had a really good time. Did we play the game Pass the Clap?
Yes, we did. We did. Yes. Yep.
So I think about that. But on the other side of it, which is, well, synchrony, of course, we're trying to get you in synchrony, but also this idea of that, like, it's any mistake is okay, we're just trying this thing. It's sort of the healthy side of that.
That's right. But some people can't do the healthy version, right? They get no. very angry with the other people in the room, and you say, but the point, you're missing the point of the exercise,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, of that. You start the book with some colorful examples of rituals by some of the world's greatest artists. Can you tell us a couple of those? And you have to do Victor Hugo.
It is extraordinary. So one thing that's so interesting to me is that we have these, we allow performers to have very elaborate rituals. Like we culturally permit them to do insane things mm-hmm. that if I stood up and started to teach a class and did the same thing, people would think I'd completely lost my mind.
Yes.
So there's a funny thing where we almost grade the level of ritual that people are allowed to do mm-hmm. by how hard it is, whatever it is that they're going to do next. And we don't do it consciously, but like an amateur tennis player, maybe they can bounce the ball twice, and then we're like, come on, serve. Mm-hmm. But Nadal can do a 73-step ritual, including picking his wedgie, which is my favorite part of his ritual.
Yes.
And we just watch it. I mean, it doesn't even occur to us, right, that it would be an outlandish thing for anybody else to do because we see, my God, this guy's going to, you know, try to serve this ball at 100 miles an hour.
Right.
Maybe he does need to wipe seven times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Pull everything and wipe.
Or Nomar.
Yes, exactly.
Nomar, as he put in the book. But because he was a Cub briefly, which I was very excited
about. Oh, that's
right. Yeah, yeah, at the end. Because there was rumors that he and Mia Hamm were moving into a house just down the street from Ann and I.
Uh-huh.
We were so excited about it. It was a complete lie. But, like, I remember and thank God baseball changed these things so that now you have to pitch, you have to go back. Because that was, like, an hour, it felt like, of ritual. Which is also really interesting in the book, and I'm still going to make you tell the Victor Hugo. But in the book, all those rituals that happen before they bat, but that's not the same in the field.
Yeah, so we do, in the same way we allow, you know, more ritual if it's harder for the performer, ourselves as well. The harder something gets, and not even harder, but the more uncertain it gets, the more likely we are to bring on ritual ourselves. And mm-hmm. so you see batters, you know, a batting champion, like, is 1-for-3. That's extraordinary,
yep.
which means they're failing most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Fielders field, like, you know, 0.987, they make 4 errors a year out of, you know, all these. And so they don't have as many rituals.
Mm.
And especially, like, outfielders don't, because they don't get that much action. So you can even see around the infield who has the most rituals by how uncertain and how fast the game comes at them. And, of course, pitchers have crazy rituals because they're like serving. They're constantly having to continue to serve and serve and serve, you know.
I want to look at game tape of Bill Buckner post ball going through legs to see if suddenly there's a bunch of rituals with him in the first base. All right, what did Victor Hugo do?
This is I shouldn't say that, but almost any famous person, if you like dive into somebody who wrote about them, they do something. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of extraordinary just how common it is. And his was if anybody's ever tried to write in your life, you know how painful
it's real hard.
Writing is mm-hmm. starting, keeping with it, you know, you have a goal and you just blow it off. And so he would take off his clothes and be naked. And he had, because he was Victor Hugo, he had a valet, and he would tell his valet to hide his clothes until he wrote the amount that he was supposed to write, and then you could have his clothes back. And it's an extraordinary, I mean, as a behavioral scientist, it's an amazing ritual. and an amazing commitment device, right? Because you literally can't leave your home because you have no idea where your clothes are.
And probably using a quill pen, which makes that even more foppish in some regard.
Exactly.
A naked Victor Hugo penning brilliant works of art.
Yeah. It changes when you read his work now. You're thinking, oh my God, this
man
was
reading
naked.
Him again. Yeah, it's done. It's, you've ruined Victor Hugo for me. So your first chapter where you talk, like, what are rituals? And I thought something was interesting because we talk about habits a lot in the podcast. We interview people about habits. Rituals are not habits, right?
That's right.
So how are they different?
There's a couple ways. So one of the things that makes them different is just that habits, for me, habits are a subset of rituals. Because, you know, for example, we have weddings, and which is clearly a ritual.
Yeah.
And we don't usually make a habit of it.
No, hopefully.
Right? So maybe some people do. But so rituals kind of encompass many, many domains of life. Habits are kind of more constrained. It's the things we're working on or the things mm-hmm. we're trying to get better at. But even within there, you can see some habits start to be more like rituals and some feel more like habits. And the easiest way I've found to figure out the difference between them is when you are getting ready for bed or in the morning, do you brush your teeth first and then shower, or do you shower and then brush your teeth?
I shower then brush my teeth.
Why?
Because I do.
when did you start?
I think, I don't know if I did it as a child.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it. I have elaborate going to bed and morning rituals. Would you like to hear them?
I would like to hear them, yeah. Okay.
So going to bed, I pour myself a little something, maybe a rye or a bourbon, and I kiss my wife always before, because I always go to bed. I go to bed obscenely early.
I see.
It's ridiculous. but I'm not necessarily going to bed right away. So I kiss her. I go upstairs.
You're retiring for the evening.
I'm retiring for the evening. Yeah. I hand my clothes to my valet. So I go upstairs, and then I have a pillow I have to take. I lay out my workout clothes. So this is a thing that, and this is, you know, maybe 6 years old in terms of deciding that I need to concentrate on my health. So I lay out all my stuff, and then I get my very specific, it's like t-shirt and pajama bottoms. If I'm reading a book, I don't turn on the TV. Otherwise, I will watch, like right now I'm watching on Apple TV, the World War II Masters of the Sky of thing. I am, my son.
Nice calm show before bed.
He said like middle age, it's either like it's divorce, a expensive car, or World War II podcasts. He's like, I'm glad you're the World War II podcast dad. And then I might go down for a second, you know, a little drink, or I'll go to bed. And then in the morning, I get up at 5 a.m. and go right downstairs and feed the dog, let the dog out, brew the coffee. Usually the papers haven't been delivered.
Coffee for you and Anne? Or just for you?
A full pot for both of us.
Yep.
Uh-huh. Which I have set the water up the night before, uh-huh. but I have not done the beans.
Yep.
You're prompting me. I'm thinking even more. And then I go up. The dog makes me pet him a second time, and sure. he knows. And then I go upstairs and I work out, but I have a very, and that's a very specific set, you listening to a podcast or two. And then I come downstairs and I shower, groom, and the brushing of the teeth is last.
I see. Huh. So in the world, for some reason, about half of people brush their teeth and then shower.
Yeah.
And about half shower and then brush their teeth. There's some people do neither.
Well, there's that.
And then there's some people who do them simultaneously. But in general, there's kind of two groups in the mm-hmm. world, which is bizarre. And most people don't know when they started doing that.
What do you do?
And well, the other thing is, of course, like your spouse can ruin it at any time, time if they mix things up.
Yeah.
I shower and then brush
as
myself. But what people who brush and then shower, again, we talked about like this disgust reaction. Like, what kind of a person would get in the shower with a disgusting mouth that hasn't been mintified? You know, what's wrong with you?
Right.
But then the key question for me for this kind of habits and rituals distinction isn't so much, you know, which order you do them in. That's just like interesting to me.
Uh-huh.
But if I ask you to, like, tomorrow morning.
Switch it up.
And then the question is, how do you feel?
Hmm. I'm sure I'd feel odd.
Odd, like what? How?
Something's off.
Something's off.
I mean, and don't you think? I mean, I don't recall you talking about this in the book, but I imagine this changes as we get older because we're cementing these things.
That's right.
So we have more flexibility when we're young. We're not going to be as thrown as much.
Yep. That's exactly right. Okay. Once we're in, I don't know what the critical age is, but there is a point at which they become quite solidified.
I have a theory about this as we're talking. So as we get older, and I think you're going to agree with me on this, we realize that no one knows what they're doing, that it's chaos. Like
absolutely.
It is a act of amazing divine intervention that we are not slamming into each other in the streets. It is that bad.
Waiting in line. I find it fascinating that we managed to wait in line for anything.
Yeah, there's that too.
We've agreed somehow.
That's even another element to what I'm talking
right.
about. In a sea of these elements. And so these habits and rituals are ways to keep us from going mad.
I completely agree. We're looking for... looking for answers.
Yeah.
Just one way to think about it.
And then we kind of deep down know there aren't any. So it's like what everyone's always talking about, like, well, what happens after death? I'm like, why are you even talking? Like, you won't know.
Exactly.
You will never know.
Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. Yeah, exactly. There are so many other things you could actually perhaps worry about. Yeah. And then what I recognize too, I think you probably as well, which is to live well, we really need these markers, both habits and rituals.
Yeah.
Right?
It's hard to think about your life without including rituals. They mark certain points. They mark transitions in our lives. You know, we graduate from things, and we don't just graduate. We do a thing with a hat.
Right.
And a scroll of paper that might be blank. Doesn't matter as long as we get the scroll.
Unless your son graduated during COVID.
Yeah, exactly.
And he didn't get it.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he went back for a thing. It is not the same thing. And I don't like I didn't care about my graduation that much, but it, you know, when you talk about this act of completion.
Yeah.
So one of the things you're very well known for is the IKEA effect. I talk about a lot in my keynotes. Can you explain what that was?
Very simple. If you make something yourself with your own hands, you come to value it more than the very same thing made by somebody else.
Yeah. So this is well known, and you write about it here. Other people write about it. And then you did this second study where you didn't let half the people complete it.
It was mean.
It was mean.
It's very mean.
And predictably, I guess, right? They didn't get that same feeling.
And it's fascinating because sometimes we have grown-ups build Lego sets for children. You know, there's 6-piece Lego sets to make a frog or something. So it takes you 10 seconds to make.
Yeah.
So if I stop you halfway through, you know that you can just finish it in 5 seconds after that, but it doesn't work. In other words, it doesn't happen because it's not done yet. You say, these are just stupid Legos. Like, I'm a grown man. I don't play with Legos for toddlers. But once you finish the Legos for toddlers, you'll kill me if I try to take it away.
You and Lighty Klotz have to get together to do some real Lego action.
It's pretty amazing. Sometimes when executives, I have them build Lego sets, again, for children, because I find that amusing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I ask them to do it, and they look at me, you know, they're like, we're paying money for this guy? I mean, who's this idiot? And then they put them together, and they're like, well, that's fine. And then I say, okay, I'm going to reuse these for the next class, so can you take them back apart and put them back in the box? You've never seen. I mean, the fear and rage. You know, I can't take this frog apart. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
this is
my
beautiful frog that I made. Very powerful. This completion of things.
You and I haven't talked about this, but I've talked about this with many of your colleagues. Like literally, your colleagues at Harvard. Real hard right now with the young people.
Yeah.
We potentially drastically underestimated the damage we were doing by keeping young people from being able to socialize during this pandemic.
We have these, I mean, one conversation that I have, our daughter is almost 8 years old, so one conversation that we often have is COVID showed us what school is for.
Yeah.
In a way that we sort of knew, but obviously school's for math and things like that, but it's also just a crucible to learn how to deal with people.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you don't learn how to deal with people, life is very, very complex and hard. You know, yeah. It's very difficult. If you can't tolerate an annoying person mm-hmm. who you just don't like.
Yeah.
They didn't even do anything wrong. No. You just don't like that guy.
Yeah, for whatever reason.
And that's going to happen in college, at mm-hmm. work, for the
and
rest of your life.
Groups of people, which is also the thing that no one ever teaches us how to like. Maybe if you put a play on or you're in a sports situation, you had to deal with a team. But otherwise, and group projects.
Yeah.
But that's not – group projects are always like you did it once a year for something.
Yep.
And I remember I had a fifth grade teacher, John McPherson. I've tried finding him, and I can't. And he got fired. but he put on a thing in our class called America, huh. where we were all given people were judges, people were laborers, whatever, and we were so terrible to each other. Like people were being thrown into jail for nothing, and they were put on trial, and it was an amazing lesson in that. And I remember, and actually my dad interviewed him on the radio because he thought it was such a compelling, wonderful thing. And this guy got fired from Joseph Sears School in North because he was effectively teaching.
Yeah. Social engineering or how they saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. One of the things that, I thought was really, really fascinating, is this idea of emo diversity. And you say, quote, the variety and relative abundance of emotions we experience, not just the predominance of positive emotions, predicts our well-being. That was surprising to me. Was that surprising to you?
It was. I think Jordi Coidbach, who's a colleague of mine who've worked together for a number of years, we were talking about really what it means to have a rich emotional life and a rich life, full stop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's, of course, the wellness industry. There's a focus on specific kinds of emotions like meaning, happiness, joy, connection. These are all great. I don't mean these are bad things. Yeah, we should have more of them. But if you think about like a rich emotional life or an interesting life, and if you just reflect on your own life, the bad things are extremely important for your sense of who you are, for growth, for challenge, for all of these things. And so we wondered, if you compare two people who just feel, you know, if you feel happy all day, every day,
mm-hmm.
sort of that's our goal with wellness, you know, we take medicine and stuff, mm-hmm. be happy all the time. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like a nightmare if you were just like a 10 happy, never anything else. It's like a disturbing kind of thought for many people. Mm-hmm. And so we wondered, you know, happy is good, but maybe like 8 happies and 2 sads might be better for your overall well-being than all happies.
I think our elders knew this because that's why Grimm's fairy tales exist, right? A lot of the children's literature... The Giving Tree?
Oh, my God.
I mean, what are you doing?
Devastating.
Cruel. Like, just a mind F. But I think and I think young people are so resilient. And I don't, you know, like, I am a perpetually optimistic human being who's been through a tragedy, as you know.
Yeah.
And I was reflecting on this, and I was sort of like, oh, yeah, no, it is, I have had great joys and great sorrows, and it is the collection of those things. Which I think Anne and I maybe had a little more insight into because we are or work with artists.
Yeah.
And a sad song, you know, like I remember listening to Jackson Browne records in my bedroom pining over a girl who didn't like me.
Uh-huh.
And the balance between
opening
that.
Farewell, maybe that's a good song for a heartbreak. Jackson Browne song. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. My first girlfriend, Allison, and then now Elvis Costello's Allison. Yeah. It's just cruel. Okay. Yeah, what it does to me.
Deadly.
but that sort of balance, that sort of, it's not even balance, I think, necessarily. It's all those things.
Yeah. We thought of it actually as a emo diversity is a very regretful term, and now we're embarrassed by it. But the reason we called it that is because we were the analogy was like biodiversity, where if real scientists evaluate some ecosystem, they look to see with species like the number of species and then their relative abundance,
mm-hmm.
meaning you can't have too many sharks and not enough minnows. Or the system's out of whack. But you need both. You need the sharks and the minnows. And we thought the same thing with emotions, which is, you can't have too many sadnesses.
Mm-hmm.
But what about if you have lots of different emotions in some abundance on each of them? Is that kind of a healthier ecosystem than all of one or when things are really out of whack.
Did you make up that term, or does that term exist?
We, unfortunately, I wish I could blame it on somebody else.
You made it up?
We made it up, yeah.
It's Emo Phillips, all the different ways he goes, the range of...
People said, is it about music? Like emo?
Yeah, emo music. No. Yeah, it was one of those two.
Really bad name, yeah.
Let's talk about savoring. And you bring up pizza. You're in Boston, I'm in Chicago. There are two great deep dish places. I like Tavern Cut. I like Thin. I like New York. I don't know why anyone would be a snob about pizza, period.
Yeah.
So
it's a gift.
It's a gift.
Yeah.
Did you watch The Bear?
Yes.
Yeah. So Pequod's is the place they go there, which is terrific. It's got this burnt crust. Uh-huh. That's like a cheese. It's burnt. It's great. But Lou Malnati's, Lou was my sort of unofficial godfather when we moved here. So I have this like, and that was the place I went to with my family. I sit near the table where my family sat.
Yes.
and my son and I will go there. What's your place in Boston?
Regina Pizzeria or mm-hmm. Pizzeria Regina. People disagree about what it's called. So, but that's mine. It's in the north end of Boston.
Yeah.
Hole in the wall.
Yeah.
It's funny that you have your place too. I'm not sure if the pizza's good or not.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
I went there with my family growing up. My parents went there when they were younger. So they have these memories mm-hmm. from being like teenagers
right.
going to this place. Now I go with my daughter to this place and it's her place. The pizza might be terrible for all mm-hmm. I know, but the memories that are there, there's no pizza that could be better.
Yeah.
There just
yeah.
isn't, right? Because it can't do all of these things that this pizza does for me.
You talk about this guy in the book.
But let me just say, I do think the pizza is good.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, please.
I don't want to
offend
me.
Just give me a shout out.
Right, exactly.
You talked about this guy in the book. I don't know if I wrote down his name or not, but he tried to figure out a shortcut because he didn't want to like worry about eating. So it was like, what?
Soylent.
It was called Soylent. That's Soylent. Right. Which is like Soylent Green.
Yes, exactly. It's a very gross, like soil. And the whole word itself is not yeah, something you would ever name a food. You would
yeah.
never name a food.
But what, like, I don't know why you, I think this is just, it feels to me like 9 out of 10 people have the same story we have with something in their life. And when they, and we all have different things we like, but when you get something, you like a milkshake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From this place with these people, you know, it's a funny thing that everyone thinks the very best pizza place in the world is typically one within a mile of where they grew up,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which just defies probability that
yeah, no, that it does.
Place would be.
I should mention this too, because you have 4 elements of savoring, and I think these are kind of important because it's not just you like something.
Mm-hmm.
Being present for positive moments and appreciating them, communicate and celebrate savoring with others, using nonverbal expressions of savoring, richly remembering past positive experiences while anticipating those details in the future. This idea of savoring containing positive mental time travel. That's all part of the equation to fully savor.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult for us. Right now I could say, you know what, I really want to feel connected to my past. And I'd really like to feel, you know, that there's some continuity in the future. But it's hard to just do it in my head.
Yeah.
And so we look for things that give us that. So religion is one where, you know, my grandparents and their ancestors have practiced this. I'm practicing it, and my descendants will practice this as well. Religion's one of the ways that we connect. And it's an incredible feeling to be connected to the past and
yeah,
the future.
Of course.
But we also use pizza.
Mm-hmm.
We use other things in our environment to connect in this way. And if we're just eating pizza to eat pizza or Soylent, this disgusting I shouldn't say that. This drink that I don't prefer.
Right.
We're losing all of that other things that we can get from the food. And consuming memory is just like a gift that we have.
Mm-hmm.
It's just extraordinary. I mean, our grandparents are gone, but we can bring them back by having literally a piece of pizza.
Right.
In a way that we just can't get if we don't have those kinds of savoring moments.
I've talked about this now too many times on the podcast, but it comes up. So during COVID... Nick had just graduated college, and then he was kind of back. He was back in Chicago, and we did a thing where we were searching for the best Italian beef in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so, at pretty much every weekend, we would try some new place together. So it combined all these elements. Right, we're in a car. Which is a great place to have a conversation. You can talk about deep stuff because you're both looking forward
totally. Not at each especially other. For men looking forward.
Especially for men who don't want to confront their emotions. Uh-huh. We would go to these unusual places, most of which, like, there were no masks. You know, we were in Trump land. It was like, you know, and then we'd have these Italian beefs, and we always ordered them the same and got the same and rated them, and would always post on social. And then so many people would weigh in. And just the other day, I took a picture. No, my friend Neil, we were having sandwiches, and he took a picture and sent me the picture of the sandwich. I posted it. And George Went, who's a friend, he's on Facebook. He's like, when is this ranking coming out? Like, I'm now known for this. But also, Nick and I have this thing, and we got interviewed by AARP magazine, or I think I wrote a thing for them, and spoke on the radio about it. Mm-hmm. But it ended up becoming kind of like this goof became kind of a powerful thing that we will have forever.
Forever.
Yeah.
And you can always revisit it, you know, 30 years from – even if you don't do it in the next 30 years.
Yeah.
30 years from now, you can get together and do it and it'd be great.
Yeah.
Great, right? In a way that other things wouldn't have that same feeling.
So number one is Johnny's in Elmwood Park, just so we are on the record with that.
It's good to know.
Can you
Are you getting like a kickback fee or anything? Is
not,
there any
not
sort
yet.
Of sponsorship?
Okay. They don't need it, man. There's lines, there's literally lines still because everyone knows. Can you talk about the experiment you did with 135 college students when you had them create time capsules?
This is it's among the favorite pieces of research I've ever been involved with. So Ting Zhang, who's a colleague of mine at HBS, came into my office and she said, this is years ago, she said, why do humans make time capsules?
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about it and we thought, what is going on? So time capsules, we take stuff, not usually important stuff, like regular stuff, like today's newspaper, we put it in a thing and then we bury it.
Yeah.
And then 10, 20, 30 years later, we dig it up.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very strange behavior that humans do. And it's very common across cultures and across time.
Okay.
So independently, humans have said, let's bury stuff and then dig it up later, rather than keep it around, because then you would have it around. And so there's a real question of what is the impulse there. And I think in the research, what we show, so if you memorialize extraordinary things, we did a study, speaking of Valentine's Day.
Yeah, yeah.
If I have you write after Valentine's Day, if I have you write about what you did on Valentine's Day, and then I take it away from you, and I show it to you again in a couple months, it's kind of interesting, but not really, because you kind of remember it.
That's
right. You know, we went to that date, you know, that was the restaurant and the thing. But the cool thing, and this was Ting's intuition, was if I just ask you to write about any other random day in February, months later, if I show you that day, you say, this is fascinating.
Yep.
Fascinating. And you would say things like, I forgot that I talked to Nick that day and had that bizarre conversation about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, whatever random things happened that day. And this idea that you can rediscover not extraordinary things, but rediscover your past in these very small, mundane ways, it's free, right? I mean, all we need to do is hide it for a bit and come back to it. And we say, this is completely, completely fascinating.
I think there's something else connected to that, which is why Seinfeld's funny.
Uh-huh.
Because he is taking the ordinary and so showing you how absurd it is.
Absolutely.
And you know, so much of comedy is surprise. And it's surprise at the insight that was right in front of it that we missed.
That's right.
Which also, in Anne and her research in comedy, is evolutionary as a way to protect us.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that idea of like, oh, we made a mistake, and instead of having it like fill us with shame or whatever, we can actually laugh out it and then get it out.
Uh-huh.
So
I have this project that I really want to do that no one will work on with me. But but the idea is there's a specific emotion that happens where, so let's say you saw a movie years ago and you liked the movie, doesn't matter what it was. Then after that movie has come out and gone away, then some other show happens with an actor on it, and that actor gets famous. Then after that, you watch the movie again that you watched a long time ago, and that actor has a tiny role in that movie.
Yeah.
And you go, that's the guy from...
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And you saw it before, but it wasn't him yet.
Yeah, sure.
And you have... People are like, that... Isn't that the guy from whatever? And what is that feeling that we like? I mean, why would that be so interesting to us to like notice this person that we didn't notice before? It doesn't matter, obviously, but we love this. It's a discovery thing, right? It's like, well, it's just a bit character, but now that I look at it, That's George Clooney or whoever it might have been in the movie.
So in the mid-90s, when Tina Fey was on the main stage, she knew that I played guitar. And she's like, hey, I want to... She wanted to play guitar in the next show. She goes, I want to do guitar lessons, but I actually don't want to like do regular guitar lessons. And the Old Town School of Folk Music, I found they're doing a class, which is you sign up and they'll teach you Elvis Costello's Imperial Bedroom on guitar.
Specifically.
Yes. Yeah, that was the class. And so I'm like, I'm in. And it was at a time where then I would need to drive her back to make call time for the show.
Uh-huh.
And so we took the class. We did the final performance. That's what we did. Years later, and I go to a lot of shows at Old Town School or whatever, I ran into the guitar teacher, and I was like, oh, yeah, Jimmy, I'm Kelly. I don't know if you remember me. He's like, well, I remember, and I remember Tina Fey was in my class. And he at the time, he didn't know it, and he was utterly delighted, and he goes, oh, yeah, no, the class, they'd like, when people found out, like, years later, they would contact me and say, could that have been Tina Fey was in the class?
Exactly.
And so I think it's a similar thing. So, you know, but that's also, that's a big Second City thing. You are coming, no one is, Tina Fey wasn't Tina Fey when she was here.
Yeah.
But people come here because they're pretty sure they're going to see the next blah, blah, blah.
Right. So 7 years from now.
That's right.
They'll say, 10. That's the guy. That's that woman from the... Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's completely true. you have a really beautiful chapter, chapter 10, called How to Mourn. And I remember when our daughter passed, Anne commented to me that she finally understood mourning clothes, that she wished she could have some symbol... So people would just know,
yeah.
But she didn't want to take on the emotional labor to tell people. So you talk about mourning clothes. So for people who don't know what that is, can you go into that a little bit?
I actually started studying rituals many years ago now because I was reading the president at the time of Harvard, Drew Gilpin Faust, is a historian. And thank you, an historian, and she wrote a book on the American Civil War and the casualty rate, which was just astronomical. And she talked about how the culture kind of made new grieving rituals to deal with the scale of death that hadn't occurred before in their culture. And first off, that's fascinating. It's not like there was a meeting and people said, why don't we do this and that? It just rituals just emerge somehow in culture, which is, as a social scientist, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But what was so interesting to me was, so they had... I might have the details wrong, but it was, you know, you wear black for a while, then gray for a while, then you can add a little bit of color like lavender, and then you can dress the way you used to dress.
Mm-hmm.
But what she showed in her research is that the amount of time that you did each of those phases depended on how close you were to the person. So if, I don't know what's more important, a husband or a brother, but anyway, whoever's more important to you, a husband was a year, and your, you know, fifth cousin twice removed was a month, whatever it might be. And as a social scientist, it's so fascinating to think that we're implicitly, in a sense, or unconsciously trying to model how long we think grief will take. We know that it's going to be harder to lose someone that we love more, and so we don't do a month.
Yeah.
We know that's not enough. We do, you know, a year. Cultures vary a lot on that.
Yeah.
But this idea that you could, anyone who's experienced grief, when you are grieving, it feels that it will never end, that the intensity will never end. And the idea is that you could look down at yourself and say, well, I'm wearing gray.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm on the road to recovery. And by the way, all these other people have gone through grief and come out the other side.
For sure.
And they did the black, gray, lavender thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of communicate, in a strange way, we communicate to ourselves that we can get through this because others have gotten through this. And many cultures have lost that, the clothing ritual.
Yeah.
And many people are happy about it because in my family, it's none of your business.
Oh, right.
But you lose this enormously important thing, which is that people know where you are. Because otherwise, and people describe this all the time, for 3 days after it happens, everybody's, you know, very condolences and things like that. And then it's back to work on Monday. People feel awkward about it.
Yep.
So they don't bring it up again.
Yep.
There's something lost when we lose these traditional rituals because humans came up with them for a reason.
Right, right.
They helped us in ways that were really important.
And for me, you know, I talk about Nora a lot in my keynotes because I think it's germane. And I also agree that, you know, culturally we do such a disservice by not talking about these tragedies because everyone has them.
Right.
Everyone. And I was doing a keynote, and this is a couple years ago, And this older woman came up to me afterwards and took my hands, and she said, I'm 82. I lost her 56 years ago. Yeah. And it's like I'm, you know, in the sea, and I'm looking up at the sun, and it's beautiful. And then a giant boat comes by, and I'm crashing under. And then I'm back up. And it's just, it could be a year, it could be 5 years. Like, it was amazing because I was like, I felt it. Yeah. Like, that is exactly where I am.
Yeah.
And then because the time period for us was like, it's Anne's birthday, it's Nora's birthday, it's Nora's death day, it's my birthday. Mm. Like, all it within like a 7 week, 8 week period.
I see.
So, right, every ritual. And so we have now sort of built in these. A lot of times on her birthday, we'll just go to Margie's Candies, which is this great, you know, it's a soda fountain. That's a, you know, and you know, whatever group it is. Or we'll go to her favorite candy place and just buy candy and then leave. Yeah. So it's not, I think we decided, like, it's not a big thing. It's a little thing. And then inside, and then now Christmas is always a thing where it's like we find the little dimpled tin candle thing she made, and we'll just make sure that there's a light on Christmas Eve or whatever. And these are little things that we do. They seem to work,
yeah,
in the sense that we're not so far into like sobbing,
yeah,
though we get sad, yeah, and we do cry.
Yeah.
But it's, if we didn't, I just feel like the absence of those kinds of rituals, what's on the other side of that is terrible.
I think it's
kind of nothing, right?
And it's, I think it's very true. And I mean, not all cultures are this way, but certainly in the U.S. it's this way, which is we don't talk about death.
Right.
We move on. You know, that's kind of the ethos of get over it. Why aren't you over it yet? Move on. Mm-hmm. And you don't even need to have grieved yourself, but once you've grieved yourself, it's completely insane to say that to somebody, you know.
Yes.
Like, you've been grieving for too long. It's like if I broke my arm and you were like, that's been healing for too long, you should take the cast off.
Yeah.
And I said, well, it's still broken though. I mean, why would I take the cast off right now? I need more time.
Right.
And we do see that people will, what was interesting is in surveys, we'll ask people, you know, think of someone you lost, and very open question, like, what did you do? Mm-hmm. And people will say funeral, you know, whatever their faith is, they'll say, we did that. I did that. And then they say, but what I really did was, and they report these very specific, yeah, idiosyncratic things to that relationship. And they've often, was so interesting to me, they've never told anybody.
Yeah.
Because they think they're crazy. They're embarrassed to admit, mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm. This one woman wrote that she washed her husband's car. Her husband passed away, and she washed his car every weekend because he used to wash it every weekend.
Mm.
She didn't drive the car.
Right.
She never told her kids because she thought they would be like, why is mom
doing that,
washing a car? Car that she doesn't drive.
Yeah.
But you can see how therapeutic that would be. As you said, if she washed the car 4 hours a day every day, then we might say, well, you know, you need something else other than that, obviously, to help yourself through this.
Yeah.
But these small actions, they're so meaningful. And compared to what?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Compared to just sitting and saying, I'm not going to think about it. It's just not how we work. We need to process and honor people.
Heidi Brooks at Yale. Do you know Heidi?
Mm-hmm.
She does a thing, and I don't know if she still does it, but it was when she would have a new cohort. She would pass out a blank piece of paper and a pen to everyone and said, don't put your name on this. Just write down a pain you're going through. Mm-hmm. And then she would just read out those. And I thought that was a wonderful way of beginning an experience of, like, just know that in this room, everyone's got something.
And whenever you're one of the, if you think of things you realize over the course of your life, it's that someone is behaving in a certain way, and you're like, well, they must be a jerk. And then you think,
right,
who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows what's going on in their life? Why would I jump to any conclusion about who they are as a human? You know, extend some grace, I think, is what I try to do as I get older.
That's right. What's the science behind open office plans? Most loaded question of the interview.
Nightmare.
Playing this for my bosses later. And I have an office. But not everyone has an office here.
Yeah. I think, I mean, the one practical thing is just it's a space saver. So of course some companies just do it because it just, you can get more people in there.
No.
But leaving that aside, there is this, I think, theory or belief that the open office kind of creates more serendipitous interactions, you know, that somehow innovation will come about because I bump into you in a way that it wouldn't have if we're all behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And there is some research that, you know, it does suggest that sometimes serendipitous interactions happen and, mm-hmm. and cool things do happen as a result. Except what people do in reaction to an open office plan, they don't do that. They put on headphones.
And, headphones.
And in any way possible, create a private space for them. You know, they stack books or whatever possible to get out of this thing.
That's right.
And so what you end up doing is it's not open office plan and people are actually just unhappy.
Right.
Because they can't be themselves. You know, they have to be hiding in plain sight. And humans don't like to be hiding in plain sight. We'd like a little space for ourselves to do our thing at work that we want to get done.
I can tell you the most unhappy office I ever walked into. Do you want to guess what company it was?
I can't.
The Onion.
Wow.
They're in. They don't even have dividers. It's just these long desks with shabbily dressed white men with facial hair. There's some women. And earphones.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, no. And this place that spits out some of the funniest things
genius.
That we've ever... Yeah.
Yes.
And they get together for meetings and other stuff, but it's grim. And I think there's, you know, there is so much other research in terms of, yeah, creative collisions, but they're that's my business. They're set up.
Yeah.
So they really are. You design times of day in which this box where you do things, you design other times of day to let in stuff.
Yes.
But even then, it's not like your work day when you have to get work done. I have a couple more things. And, talk about the straw hat incident of September of 1922. This is insane.
I actually forget when and how I came across this example. I wish I could remember, but whenever I came across, as you said, it's completely insane. So in this particular time period, a certain dip, of course, as you know, we all used to wear straw hats.
Yeah, we all.
At this particular time period in history, there was a date at which it became not appropriate to wear a straw hat. It was time to wear something else other than a straw hat.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find an example that was more trivial than... Why would I be upset at whatever hat, you know?
You're wearing, yeah.
God bless. Enjoy your hat, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And the story is basically about how there were riots in the street and attacks by gangs of roving men looking for people wearing straw hats to knock their hats off and beat them up. Because they were so offended at the idea of a straw hat after, I forget the date, but what after whatever date it was.
Fisticuffs.
Exactly, with the pants pulled up really
yeah,
high.
Yeah,
you know,
really
they used
high.
To be in the 30s kind of thing. It's extraordinary. And, you know, people went to jail. I mean, you know, this is like a real, these were real assaults and
did
real
people.
Did
they go people. To jail for wearing the straw hat, or did they go to jail for beating up the guy with a straw hat? Maybe both.
Maybe both.
Wow.
The jail term for wearing a straw hat was 20 years, but beating someone up was like an hour and a half.
I want to tell you, so we're back in this How to Divide chapter, and I wanted to tell you about an exercise we created we designed orientation programs for the University of Chicago when we were doing Second Science Project.
Mm-hmm.
And hearing one another, they still do it, and hearing one another is one of them. And one of the opening exercises that we lead is an exercise called I Am Somebody Who. Mm-hmm. So... Anne helped design this, and she would have everyone get in a circle, and she says, okay, when I'm going to describe something, first about myself, but then about other folks, and if you identify with the thing I'm saying, move to another part of the circle. So I am somebody who wears jeans. I am somebody who is vegan. I am somebody who owns a gun. And I think what happens is you can't believe that the vegan is a gun owner who is libertarian.
Uh-huh.
You can't believe that the gardener also listens to thrash metal.
Uh-huh.
And because the movement happens as well, the circle and its movement, it throws you off in the best possible way. And it's a beginning exercise because we're going to take you through a number of these exercises, which are all about how to see through difference and speak through difference and that sort of thing.
I love this. I love that exercise because I think we're so quick to reduce people to a single attribute.
Right.
Because it's easier.
Yeah.
You know, that person believes this political thing that I don't believe. I'm not even going to talk to them about anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess sometimes that could be warranted, but whatever you reduce people to, these vegans are ruining everything, whatever people are upset about, you know, in the world. And it's, of course, you know, they're not a vegan. Like, that's not who they are as a person. They just happen to practice that certain diet. But as you said, they also are all these other things. And I think it's important, even if you don't find commonalities, just to see them as a fully realized person instead of like a caricature of whatever attribute you're focused on.
Well, this is why I'm so amused by the Kansas City Chiefs, the San Francisco 49ers, Travis Kelce, Taylor Swift, and all these people looking to try to take a position when there is no position to be taken. Because like a pretty rich girl has a boyfriend who plays football,
I know,
and she likes to cheer him on. They're like to find something so horrible about that is, and the jokes are good. Like this is the one good thing about social media is everyone making fun of this. But people really, I mean, Fox News literally has segments on this.
Yeah, the anger at these sorts of things is very, faux anger can be very funny.
Yes, yeah.
But real rage at the most innocuous things that don't affect you in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
We get this, there's this feeling, I can't believe these people. Can you believe these people? Very strange mindset that we have.
So dumb. All right, I have a last question for you before we ask for a yes and story. Dusty Baker invented the high five?
We think.
I Googled it.
The scientists think.
More than Wikipedia, most, when I Googled it, because I was like, all right, this can't, like.
Seems impossible.
No, it seems like he kind
of
did.
Yeah, because one of his teammates just was celebrating with his hands up in the air, and Dusty Baker said, I'm going to whack him.
Okay.
That was it. I'm going to slap those hands.
And then they kept doing it?
Kept doing it because it, as we see when we high five, it's fun to high five. So it just catches on, you know.
That's not that long ago.
I know, it's insane, and it's so ubiquitous. And so people are like, where did the handshake come from? Probably two people a thousand years ago.
Yeah,
you know, maybe one of them fell and the other one grabbed their hand and they thought, well, that was cool. Mm-hmm. And now we've been shaking hands for thousands of years. You know what I mean?
Yeah, until COVID screwed that up.
Right, exactly. Well, then we do elbows.
Yeah, I remember elbows.
And it is interesting to me that we need to do something still.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I think we told you when you guys were visiting that the ritual backstage is I got your back.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And I think that there's just something really lovely about that, and it sets you up. But yeah, the Dusty Baker, you know, because he coached the Cubs and we had, like, I think I had an In Dusty We Trust t-shirt, if I'm not mistaken. Because he did, like, amazing. Yeah. Yeah, invented the high five.
Incredible baseball player, incredible manager, and he will be remembered for the high five.
And he'll be remembered for the high five. Do you have a yes and story for us?
I should have prepared.
No, you don't have to prepare.
Let me think.
Because the thing is, the reason we ask is, like rituals, I think you do, you yes and every day.
Hmm.
And I think, the difference between habits and rituals, it's easier to say no. Like our habit is to, when Richard Thaler, we first led, Anne led, she was teaching exec ed class with Thaler and did the yes and exercise. And he's like, that's a nudge. I'm like, yeah, okay. and he's not wrong. But in behavioral economics, we know people's default position is to say no or do nothing.
Yes.
And so we're like, so when you take it out of the improv context, it's like, oh no, this is the antidote to Netflix and chill.
Mm-hmm.
It's the idea of like, oh, like I am the other night I had tickets to Roseanne Cash at the Old Town School of Folk Music, small venue, and Anne was sort of like, I'm tired, and I said, I think you want to go, I think there's going to be something special tonight.
Uh-huh.
And as Roseanne Cash, it was like staring
into the middle of America through a woman's voice. It was her and her husband. Her husband is an incredible guitarist, like John Leventhal. Mm. He's got a new album out. It's great. And he's playing this stuff as she's doing talk singing about, you know, the sunken lands in Arkansas, and starts talking about her dad, Johnny Cash, giving her the list, the 200 songs. That was her education.
Wow, yeah.
And then she's her encore. She's doing 500 miles, and literally I turn to Anne sobbing.
Yeah.
And like one of those things, like,
you knew.
Thank you for yes-anding me on this thing. And yeah. We left. There was so much was going on there. But the no would have been easier, and you would have missed this. I honestly, it was a seminal, I love live music, and this is like a top 10 experience for me.
It's so interesting. Mm-hmm. I think the science is basically, one view that scientists have of science is that you criticize.
Sure.
That you poke holes and you try to show that people are wrong and that you're right, but mainly just that people are wrong. And it can be, and that's good science. I mean, you know, we should be testing things and being critical. But it's not actually what science is. Science is the discovery of new things, mm-hmm. not the critique of existing things. Mm-hmm. And so we have in our lab a rule, which is very often in science, you'll say something and someone will say, isn't this just something else? All the time. Isn't this just, for in our field of view, isn't this just cognitive dissonance?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's like, isn't this just people thinking? Well, yeah, but that's not, you know, I mean, yes, technically,
yes,
but
technically.
What a useless comment.
It's just someone stringing words together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Isn't this just a social construction? So we have this rule. If anybody says, isn't this just, we shut it down. And what you have to say instead is, you know what else you could do?
Okay, that's a good one.
So we really try in our lab, and I just try as a scientist, I think, is this idea of someone gives you something. Maybe it's not the best idea. Maybe the project is horribly flawed. The approach is, it's yes and. Let's just accept that there's something good in there. You know what else you could do is this, this, and this. And most scientists, sadly, are more the, isn't this just? And I wish more of us would be a little bit more, you know what else you could do.
The book is called The Ritual Effect, From Habit to Ritual, Harnessing the Surprising Power of Everyday Actions. Mike Norton, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Screaming atop of their lungs.
survive.